Okay, Proverbs chapter 12, and we'll be finishing the chapter today. Last week we covered verses 15 through 21, and I kind of lumped all of them together just kind of informing us about a fool or foolish behavior. We saw in those verses that a fool rejects counsel. He lacks self-control. A fool disregards truth. Verse 18, he's careless with his words. Verse 19, he has no future. Verse 20, a fool can't be trusted. And verse 21 is where we ended at, that a fool lacks God's direction. Person who lives foolishly cannot have God directing their steps. So anyway, we come down to verse number 22, and we'll just pick up there and cover these last six verses, I think it is, seven verses, tonight. Just kind of a brief look at each one of them, and that'll be our study for tonight. But anyway, let's just go ahead and pick up with verse number 22, and it says, "Lying lips are abomination to the Lord, but they that deal truly are his delight." Have you noticed in Proverbs how often it talks about lying and lying lips?
Yes.
It speaks of lying quite often, right? And I think one of the reasons for that, obviously it says here that lying lips are an abomination to God, but why would God look so unfavorably at a lie? In society and culture, we have normalized lying and falsehood, haven't we? It's kind of expected in some areas in life, and we have dumbed it down a little bit to where they're not as severe as they could be, right? We've got little white lies. We've got small untruths. We've got ways that we've made it sound better to lie, right? But at the end of the day, if it is not true, it is a lie. And it tells us here that lying lips is an abomination to God. And one of the reasons why that is an abomination is in John 8:44, we find that the devil is the father of lies. So where does lies come from? What does lies characterize? Who is it that is identified with lies? It is Satan. And it tells us in Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 18 that it's impossible for God to lie. Jesus tells us that he is the way, the truth, and the life, that all truth originates with God, that all things operate according to the way that he has put them out. And so we see a divide here. Two different ways, two different options before us. One identified with Satan, one identified with God. We also see that one of the first acts of Satan, one of the first interactions that we find in Scripture is that in the Garden of Eden, and it centers around lies. It centers around Satan doing what Satan does. And so as Satan comes down to Adam and Eve, God has made the creation. He has pronounced it all good. Everything is perfect. Everything is holy. Everything is just. Everything is right. Adam and Eve live in absolute perfection, heaven on earth, except Satan is there, and Satan is a corrupt being. And as they are going about their day-to-day life, God has given them a religious responsibility. God has given Adam and Eve, he says, you can eat off of everything. You can enjoy all of it. Everything is yours freely to give, or freely to partake of, freely to enjoy, except for one tree is off limits. And that one tree is placed there as an option, as a test, if you will. And we might say, God, that's unfair that you would put that there. God, that's unfair that you would put a temptation there. But is it a temptation? It shouldn't have been, okay? But what it was a choice, and it was a choice for them to where they had an option besides obeying God. Because if there was no option besides obeying God, there's no choice, and man would just be God's pet. Man would just be almost a robot. It would just, we need a choice. In order for God to be glorified, in order for love to be true and to be shown, there had to be a choice, and God gave them a choice. And even that is one of the reasons why God allowed Satan to be there, because Satan has no power unless God allows him. He can do nothing unless God allows him to do it. So anyway, getting off course just a little bit, back to the garden, we find that Adam and Eve are in their perfection. They are enjoying all things, and Eve is admiring the fruit that was forbidden. And as she is admiring the fruit, Satan is there. He sees her admiring the fruit, and he begins to talk with her.
Yeah.
And by the way, whenever we entertain these thoughts, whenever we allow the devil even a hairbreadth in our lives, he is going to take more and more and more.
Yeah.
He's not happy to just whisper before you know it. He's going to be shouting in your ear.
Mm-hmm.
And so we find that Satan comes and confronts Eve, and he says, "Yea, hath God said?" Did God really say this? He twisted a little bit. You may eat of all of the fruit of the garden. And what he is doing is he is drawing the spotlight on the one thing that God says, thou shalt not. You know, we have great liberty. We have so much that we can enjoy in this life, so many good things. But you know what we tend to have our focus and our attention drawn to? That which we're not supposed to do. Think about all that was available to Adam and Eve. Think about everything that they could enjoy and they could partake of. But what was she drawn to? What was Satan pointing out? Yeah, God said that you may eat of every tree of the garden. She said, well, everyone except for that one. So he's taking the word of God, he is twisting it, he is making a lie. Because he knew for a fact that God didn't say you may eat of every tree. He knew that one, but he's making a lie, and the lies bring forth temptation. Right? The lies excuse temptation. You see why God hates lies, why it's abominable? Not only that, but whenever Eve says, well, we may eat of every tree except for this one, and the day that we eat of it, God says we can't eat of it, neither shall we touch it, or we'll die. He's already got her confused and adding to the word of God. And then Satan says, you shall not surely die. A lie to get rid of the consequences of sin. Right? Isn't that what we typically do? One of the reasons why people lie is to try to either justify sin or to get out of it.
Yeah.
Think about all the lies that we see or that we hear or that we have told, and we are trying to get either away from the consequences of sin or to justify the action of sin. And so it's all tied into sin. And well, why are things sin? Because they are bad for us. And so Satan is trying to tell Eve what God says is bad for you is not really bad for you. That's a lie. And Eve fell for the lies. She fell for this. She became entrapped. And all of mankind, all of creation, was corrupted and fell as a result of believing the devil's lies. And so whenever we try to justify lies, when we try to dumb them down or simplify them or make them as if they're not so bad, we don't realize how severe they really are. And how we've already found out through the book of Proverbs that little lies turn into greater lies. One lie is covered by another lie. We see that lies end up being, as the poet said, a tangled web. And so God looks at lies and he says, don't even allow it to enter into your mind. He says that it is abominable to me. It's not just something I hate, but it is abomination to me. And if we want to, we're not going to do this tonight, but if we wanted to study out just a little bit more and look at the other things that God lumps in as an abomination. And a lot of them were like, hey, abomination, yeah, I can get on board. That's definitely abominable. That's horrible. That's awful. This is, but lying's not so bad, is it, God? Well, it's a tool of Satan that he calls us to, that he uses to reap all sorts of corruption in the world today. That's how he's always operated. He uses lies. That is his main tool. That is one of his main objects. And so he uses lies to corrupt, to deceive, to defile, to cause all sorts of shame and problems. And God looks down at it and says that should have no part in a believer's life. As a matter of fact, in verse number, 22, it says, they that deal truly are his delight. Lying lips are an abomination, but they who deal truly are his delight. So if we want to please God, and by the way, we all a lot of times make it out as if it's harder to please God than what it really is. God is not unjust. He is not unreasonable. The Bible talks about uh, I'm trying to remember the exact verse, but anyway, serving him and living for him is a reasonable service. Presenting our bodies to him as a living sacrifice is a reasonable service, it says. God's reasonable. And so whenever we look at this, something that is pleasing to God, they that deal truly are his delight. He delights in honesty. Put lies far from you. Tell the truth. Be an honest person. Be a person of integrity. And God says, hey, I like that. I delight in that. Is that hard? Just to not be a liar? He's not setting the bar that high, is he? So he says, lies, abomination. Truth, delight. Simple enough, isn't it? And so whenever we realize who we're identifying with by these behaviors, it kind of lets us know which camp we want to be in. I don't want to be going Satan's pathway. I don't want to be following after him. I want to do things that please God. So whenever lies start coming to my mind and temptation starts coming about to bend the truth, to twist the truth, to all of these things, it's like, wait, no, that's not of God. That's not something that should be proceeding from my mouth. That's not something that I should be tempted to do. And so we should be putting that far from us. And if we're tempted to do it, then we need to go unto God and say, God, I know this is not of you. Help me not to succumb to this temptation. Help me to not follow after this path and follow after this deception. I want to be honest. I want it to be true. I want to be your delight. Right? And so there is a lot of Bible dedicated to honesty to truth versus lying. Okay? And so, anyone got anything to add to that? I don't want to spend all of our time on one verse. Okay. I don't think that should be controversial in any way, right? We know that lie, bad, truth, good. I think we're taught that from an early age. We know these things. Okay. Verse 23. A prudent man concealeth knowledge, but the heart of fools proclaimeth foolishness. We already looked in verse number 16. It says, a fool's wrath is presently known, but a prudent man covereth shame. And we see this idea in both verses of a man who is prudent, a man who is wise, that he is able to hold things back. He is able to control himself a bit. Okay? In verse 16, it was talking about emotions, that a prudent man was going to cover shame. He wasn't going to just lash out and make his anger and his wrath known, but he was going to actually subject his emotions to truth and process those and give them a little bit of time and handle them properly, right? But here we find what he does with his words, what he's going to be doing with the things that he knows with his knowledge. And it says that he conceals knowledge. Is he hiding it, making some kind of a game out of it? Is he trying to know what it is that a prudent man knows when to speak and when to be quiet. He doesn't have to say everything that he knows. He doesn't have to go around and brag about all the knowledge that he has and all the wisdom that he has and be speaking all of these things, but a prudent man is going to keep back some of that knowledge. He's going to set on some, as the, this may not be a good analogy to use, but where they talk about not showing all your cards. You play a game, you can't show all your cards. And that's what it's saying. The prudent man, he knows when to be quiet. And it's not just when, but who as well. A prudent man knows who he can speak to and who it's best to remain quiet around. Who he can confide in and who he better be quiet around. That's common sense. That's prudence, isn't it? And so if you say everything you know to everybody you come across, that's not smart. And so what it tells us here, a prudent man concealeth knowledge, but the heart of fools proclaimeth foolishness. The foolish person can't keep their mouth shut. They have to speak. They have to make whatever it is known that they know. And if they don't know it, they'll make it up. They'll pretend they know it. They'll talk a big game because they want people to think well of them. They want people to brag on them. They want people to see all that they know, but the prudent man is able to sit there and be quiet. A lot of times it's because he's sitting there being quiet, so he's listening. So he's gauging the people who he is around of who it is that he can trust, who it is he can confide in, who it is that actually has an interest, who it is that can handle the information that he has, who it is that he should even be sharing it with, and who it is that's able to contribute to the knowledge that he has. The old adage is that we have two ears and one mouth. We should do twice as much listening as we do speaking. All right? And so the prudent man doesn't say everything he knows, doesn't always have to speak. But whenever we see the fool, he thinks he must be heard. He overestimates his contribution while being oblivious to what other people have to offer. Because while he's speaking, other people aren't speaking. Right? And so someone who dominates the conversation and gives information that's unsolicited is telling everyone around them that they know it all and everyone else has nothing to offer them. Isn't that what it says? And so it's a foolish concept. Whenever I think about this, I think about Job and his friends. You ever read the book of Job and get aggravated? Get frustrated? Because his friends just have to speak up. There's even places where they're talking about, I am full of matter. I have to let this out. I just have to. I've listened to you long enough, Job, and I just have to let this out before I explode. And Job tells them that if they would have kept their mouth shut, it would have been their wisdom, I think is what it says. In other words, if you would have been quiet, someone might have mistaken you for someone smart. That's what he's telling his friends. I mean, they have some biting exchanges in the book of Job, and for good reason. But his three friends just constantly can't contain themselves, and they just have to tell Job like it is. They have to straighten him out. And by the time it's over with, God gets tired of listening to him. And God tells him to be quiet. Now that's pretty severe, isn't it? I hope I'm never speaking and God shuts me up. Because you really have to be overstepping quite a bit for God to say, okay, this is enough. I've got to make him be quiet. But anyway, I don't know, maybe some people's prayed for that in the past. It's like, he's never going to shut up, make something. He's going to fall over, get struck by lightning, something. I don't know. Okay, so 23, a prudent man concealeth knowledge, but the heart of fools proclaim foolishness. I'll point out too as the last thought on this. It says the heart of fools. Out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaketh. And so they are fools at heart. And so the only thing that can proceed from their mouth is foolishness. Okay. Verse number 24. The hand of the diligent shall bear rule, but the slothful shall be under tribute. Whether good or bad, leadership of power and authority is not a place for lazy people. You know what? A lazy man is not going to rise to a place of power, of authority, of rule. And if he's put there when he shouldn't be, he's not going to stay there for very long. Because those type of places, whenever you're leading people, whenever you're ruling over people, it takes work. It takes effort. It takes energy. For a person to be able to climb to that place, to earn that respect, earn that position, it's going to take them being intentional about it. It's going to take them working at it, and it's not going to be for the lazy. It's not for the faint of heart. And so they have to be diligent. And so what we see in verse number 24, the hand of the diligent shall bear rule. Even some of the most wicked rulers that we have seen in history, okay, have been very diligent people. They were putting their diligence toward wickedness, right? Just for an example, we have Saul of Tarsus and Paul the Apostle. We talked about them on Sunday. Okay? Paul was a very diligent person. He was very zealous for whatever he was doing. And before he was saved, before he came to the Lord, he was very, very zealous. He was very diligent. And so at a young age, he had rose through the ranks of the Pharisees and of the maybe even the Sanhedrin. He was in a place of authority, a place of leadership. He was going about leading people in the persecution of Christians, and he wasn't just sitting at home idly by, but he was out there leading the charge, leading the warfare. He was out there making a name for himself, and I don't figure he had all that much time to rest, right? And so God says, hey, how about we set him right and harness that for good? He gets saved, and he's still just as diligent, just as zealous as he ever was, but now it's harnessed for right things instead of wrong things. You look at other people through history, other leaders. I hate to even mention this one, but I said evil or good, right? Do you think that Adolf Hitler was a lazy man? There's no way he could have been. Now, was he given to the flesh? Yes. Was he given to excess? Yes. But was he lazy? Doubt it. And so you don't rise up to that kind of a position of power or rule without having some zeal, some diligence. A lazy person doesn't do that. Okay? And in public office, in politics, anywhere, it takes a little bit of diligence. It takes putting in the hours. It takes the work. And so it says there in the last part of that verse, the slothful shall be under tribute. The idea of being under tribute, that is a conquered people. It is a people who is paying tribute to the one who defeated them. They are vassals of another empire. Okay? And so how does all this apply to us today? Well, think about it for a minute. If we desire to advance, if we desire to accomplish anything, if we desire, whether it's in the kingdom of God, if we're wanting to do anything for God and for his glory, we're not going to be able to be lazy about it. If we want to advance at work, if we want to advance in our job, if we want to do well in our family, we're not going to be able to be lazy about it. It takes diligence to bear rule, to rule well. It takes diligence to get that place of honor and authority. Okay? There's the idea today that kids are getting directly out of school and they're expecting to be in leadership positions. That's dumb, isn't it? That's the way it works. They have to first be under rule for a while. They have to serve diligently, and promotion should come, because of merit, right? Now, in the corrupt world which we live in, it doesn't always. Sometimes it's who you know, or as we were talking about the other day, what you look like or what you're sexual orientation. You know, there's all these other things that they try to put you in front of everyone. But here's the thing. If you are achieving those positions by any other reason than that you are working and you are diligent and you are putting the effort out, you're not going to be able to sustain that position. And you're definitely not going to be able to do that well. Okay? It takes diligence to advance. It takes diligence to lead. It takes diligence to lead well in wherever you're at, whether it's in the home, the family, at the workplace, wherever you're at. It takes diligence to lead and to lead well, right? And so the slothful, he may as well just get used to where he's at. He's not going to make progress. If he's going to be slothful, if he's going to be lazy, just be happy with the minimum effort, minimum output, right? And so there is the encouragement there that whatever we set our hand to do, we do it with all of our might, right? We're diligent about it. The Bible tells us whatever we do, what's the verse? Whatever your hand findeth to do, do it something. Do it heartily, as unto the Lord. There you go. So that's basically what's teaching there. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it heartily. Do it diligently. Put some effort into it, like you're doing it for God. And I think that's a good principle for us as Christians, that if we're working our job down at the office or wherever we're at, okay, I'm not doing this for the paycheck. I'm not doing this to to please my boss. I'm doing this because I'm a child of God. And I'm going to do this to bring him glory. I'm going to do this to make him look good. I'm going to do this so that people know I belong to him. Because your boss, he may not be worth working for. Your paycheck, you might not be happy with. Say, okay, I'm going to do this heartily as unto the Lord. And you put forth the effort, God will reward you for it. Okay. Anything to add to that one? Okay. Verse 25. Heaviness in the heart of a man maketh it stoop, but a good word maketh it glad. We all know the feeling of heaviness in the heart, right? And I think there's a little bit of heaviness today. Everybody just tired, had a rough day, maybe. But anyway, we know the feeling of heaviness in the heart. It can be from grief or from sadness, from disappointment, discouragement, depression, disillusionment, right? There's different reasons why we are heavy. Sometimes it can be physical. Sometimes it can be psychological. Sometimes it can be circumstantial. But sometimes we are just heavy. And that heaviness that you can feel in your chest, your heart is stooping. Maybe called anxiety. Right? And so we know this heaviness. Life is full of times of heaviness. And it's not good to go through it alone. As much as sometimes we want to pull away from everyone and just kind of go and pout in our corner, it's not good for us. I often point out Elijah, and whenever he goes to his cave and pouts by himself and wishes for death. But whenever we look at Paul's words in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 2, he tells us that we're to bear one another's burdens. That in the times whenever hearts are stooping, whenever there's times whenever people are discouraged, people struggling, having a hard time, they need people around them that are willing to speak this word of encouragement. They need someone that's willing to come alongside of them and bear under the burden with them and help them with it. Sometimes it doesn't require words. Sometimes it's just being there or being available, just in supporting them in whatever way. But Solomon tells us the value of a good word in this passage. It says, a good word maketh it glad. Sometimes it just takes the right person saying the right thing to turn things around. But as we see this here, it's got to be the right word. It's got to be a good word. You ever been in a bad place, been discouraged, been depressed, your heart stooping, and someone said something stupid to you? Most likely. Someone said the wrong thing. Maybe insensitive. Might have been me. Empathy may not be my strong suit. But anyway, we have to be careful with our words whenever people are in the place of discouragement, of depression, when their heart is stooping. We have to be careful with our words because careless words can actually add to the weight. Flippant advice and worthless cliches are of no help, really, whenever it comes to a heavy heart. Whenever you say, oh, you know, just think on how good God is. Things aren't really that bad. Right? It's like, that's not helping me any. Just smile. I'll just pray about it. Right? You can probably add to it better things than what I can. Things that maybe you've heard whenever you were not feeling so good. I just get over it. Right? It's like, thanks. I think I'll do that. I'll just get over it. I'll be all right. No. But we find that a good word maketh it glad. I already mentioned Job's friends, but I've got a couple of passages from Job examples where his friends weren't helpful. In Job chapter 13, verses 4 and 5. This is the verse I alluded to earlier. Job speaking, and he talks to his friends. And he says, but you are forgers of lies. You are physicians of no value. Oh, that you would altogether hold your peace and it would be your wisdom. He says, you've spoke a lot of words, but none of them helped me. You didn't make my heart any lighter. You made it heavier. It'd have been better off if you had just been quiet. In chapter 16 and verse 2, Job speaking again. He says, I have heard many such things. Miserable comforters are ye all. He says, you're not helping any at all. And so this is where I'm getting at with this passage, is good words make it glad. And I venture to say that the ability to say the good words comes from experience, comes from age, comes from faithful service to God. A lot of times that's where they come from. It's easy to be flippant and foolish with our words when we can't relate to what the person's going through. It's easy to be flippant and rash with our words whenever we haven't felt the feelings they're feeling. Whenever we haven't tread the valleys that they're treading, whenever we haven't felt those heavy feelings, those difficulties that they're feeling, whenever we can't relate to it, we're not going to form the words that need to be spoken. I know from personal experience, I have been in places where I was trying to comfort people who were going through things that I've never experienced, and I didn't have the words. People who were suffering loss, going through pain, people at the point of death or losing loved ones and different things like that, that honestly, I didn't really have the words for. And I would have been foolish to really say much of anything. There was one conversation I had years ago. I was out on bus visitation, and Les and I were taking kids to church on the church van and things. And I went and knocked at this one guy's house, and he says, you know, I'd love for my kids to go to church, but right now is not a good time. He says, my wife just left me. She's got the kids most of the time. They're probably not going to be here. And he said, everything's just a mess. And I looked at him and he said, I told him, I have no clue what you're going through, and I don't want to. I don't want to understand those feelings. I hope I never have to. But I said, I'm not going to pretend like I know what you're going through. And he was so grateful that I didn't try to pretend like I knew, that I didn't offer fake words of comfort, that I just let him be where he was. I just kind of validated that I knew it was hard, that he was going through something difficult, because so many people say dumb things in times like that. And that's not to lift myself up. That is me acknowledging at that time, the best thing I could say is I don't have words. I don't understand. And he's like, you're right. You don't understand. But thank you for admitting that. Okay? And so that's just an example. But that's where it's so vital and so valuable that we bring our experiences in to our walk with God, that we don't try to cover the sorrows, the hardships that we've been through, the mistakes that we've made, the failures that we suffered, because we can minister one to another through those. The people who've been walking with God for a while and they've went through dark times and they've made mistakes, they can minister to the ones that are doing it now, right? And so whenever you're going through difficulties, when you're going through hard times, whenever you're in those places of heaviness of heart, it might be wise for you to look out someone who may have the words that you need to hear, that may be able to speak into that. Ignore some of those people who are going to speak foolishness, those are the ones that can't speak into your situation, and go out and look for someone who is faithful, who is godly, who has seen some battles, who's went through some stuff, and go and sit beside of them and say, I'm going through this and I just need a little bit of help. And they can probably speak some words of wisdom to you. They can probably speak some words of comfort, and they may be able to ease that heaviness. Okay. Does that make sense to everyone? And so that gives us a lot of a lot to think about, both when we're going through hard times and heaviness, and whenever we're around other people who are. We need to be careful with our words, and sometimes we need to seek those who have the words we need to hear. Guys, got any thoughts on that? You guys don't have the words either, huh? Okay, verse 26. The righteous is more excellent than his neighbor, but the way of the wicked seduceth them. Just to be honest, this verse gave me a little bit of trouble. Okay? As I was researching, as I was looking it up and trying to work my way through it, the righteous is more excellent than his neighbor. Does that mean he's holier than thou? We've got to remember this is from God's perspective whenever he's talking about excellence. But see, here's the thing about our flesh and about us as mankind. We are seeking to excel. We're seeking to do better than the person beside of us, right? We've got the saying, keeping up with the Joneses, right? You're tempted to look at the household beside of you. You see how they're doing materially, financially. You see the different things, and a lot of times the way that they're presenting themselves. You see the best part of them, and you get jealous of the way that they're doing, and you want to excel. You want to do past them, right? But what the verse says here is the righteous is more excellent than his neighbor. It's changing our perspective. It's shifting our perspective on what excelling is. And it's saying that if you want to excel, if you want to be doing well for yourself, it's not necessarily paying attention to your neighbor, but it's paying attention to God, paying attention to righteousness. It's living a righteous life. If you want to be on the track to do well, don't be looking at the next guy over here. Don't be trying to exceed the neighbor, but instead be righteous. And if you're being righteous, you will be excelling, right? You won't have to worry about, am I better than them? If I want to excel, if I want to do well, if I want a good life, if I want a good path, live righteously. And that's been a theme all throughout Proverbs, is the righteous life is the best life. Living godly is the way to go. If you want to do well, live by God's principles. Live a way that pleases God, okay? Because we get to the second half of this, and I think this is where it sheds light on it. Because in the middle of the verse, we have the word but. It tells us it's a contrast. You've got this that goes this way, but this goes this way, right? And it says, but the way of the wicked seduceth them. So the righteous is more excellent than his neighbor. The righteous person's way is the best way, okay, is what it's saying. Because we're talking about ways, right? The way of the wicked seduceth him. What does it mean to seduce? Anyone know what seducing is? To seduce would be to deceive, to trick, to overcome, right? Often by wiles, by deceit, things like that. We often think of it in a relational or sexual way of the unchaste woman trying to seduce the guy, the harlot trying to seduce the guy, or the guy trying to seduce the unwitting woman, right? It's like the spider trying to catch its prey. It's trying to trick something into its web, right? Seduction. And it says that the way of the wicked seduces them. Them who? The wicked. They're being seduced by their way. They're being tricked. They're being deceived. They're getting caught in the web, if you will. And so it puts all of this into perspective, because as we're living our lives and we're going alongside of our neighbor And if we're trying to go the way of the rest of the world, we're trying to excel, we're trying to exceed, we're trying to compete, we're trying to do better. We think that we are doing well. We are piling up for ourselves riches. We are getting the promotions. We are doing all of the things that the world says that we're supposed to do. And we think that this is the way to success. We think that this is the way to happiness. And it is seducing. It is deceiving. It is tricking because it is making us live for the wrong purpose, for the wrong reason. It doesn't bring fulfillment. It doesn't bring life. We'll see that in verse number 28. And so it says, the excellent way is righteousness. But the way of the wicked, they think they're going to excel. They think that they're going to do well. They think that things are going to be great for them, and they're actually headed for destruction. So you've got a choice, right? One example that we have in Scripture is that the Lord tells about the rich fool. He says that he goes out, he does great at farming and cultivation and everything. His fields bring forth by handfuls. He says, I don't have big enough barns to bestow all of my riches. I'm going to tear down my barns. I'm going to build bigger barns to bestow all of my riches. And I'm going to say to my soul, you have plenty. Just sit back and enjoy yourself. Right? And the Lord calls him a fool and says, this night your soul will be required of you. Was he a fool because he had riches? No. Was he a fool because his land brought forth abundantly? No, God gives the increase, right? What was he the fool for? If we look through that passage, he uses the first person pronoun, I, me, about 12, 13 different times. He is foolish because of what he's living for. He's foolish because of who he's living for. He's foolish because he thinks that his life is in his hands. He thinks he's got it under control. He thinks his safety and his security is in himself and the things that he possesses. And he is a fool because he is giving no credence to God, to God's way toward his righteousness. That story would be made completely different if he just acknowledged God in it anywhere. Right? And so whenever we come down to this verse, in verse 26, the righteous is the man who is acknowledging God, acknowledging God's way, and seeking to live a way that pleases God. And he says, you're going to find an excellent way. You're going to excel beyond your neighbors. Okay? But if you go the way of the wicked, you're only going to think that you are doing well until it's too late. You've been deceived. Okay. Verse 27, the slothful man roasteth not that which he took in hunting, but the substance of the diligent man is precious. We've got the diligent man again. And we have a similar idea to what we've seen in verse number 10. Verse 10, it said, a righteous man regardeth the life of his beast, but the tender mercies of the wicked are cruel. And we talked about how the righteous man even had a different perspective about material goods and about the things that he had, even about his animals, right? When a person knows God, whenever a person loves God, I believe it was your mom that said, whenever man gets saved, even his dog knows it. Okay? It's that idea that a righteous man is going to steward things differently. He's going to see things differently. And in this passage, it talks about the slothful man, a lazy man, goes out hunting, shoots his animal, leaves it lay. The area that we came from, there's a lot of hunting, and we despise people who would shoot an animal and leave him lay. It's wasteful. It's disrespectful to God, to his creation, right? Disrespectful to that animal that he shot. If you're going to shoot it, at least take it and use it, right? But that slothful man, that lazy man, he has no respect for the things of God. He has no respect for a life or a limb. He has no respect for property. He has no respect. You ever see someone who mistreated anything that came into their hands? Didn't matter if it was an animal, a tool, a possession, a house, or any. They rent your house and they leave it trashed. You know, that's that kind of a deal. But we come to the last part of the verse. It says, but the substance of a diligent man is precious. That man has had to work for the things that he has. He has put effort into it, and so it means more to him, right? And so for him, what he has is precious. He's not going to misuse it. He's not going to waste it. He's not going to abuse it. You have the old saying, waste not, want not. You ever heard that? No. My family has, none of the rest. And so, as I said, a diligent man that works hard for his things are going to take care of the things that he has. But for the lazy man or the man who had things come to him easily, easy come, easy go, right? Just kind of an example. Maybe I should say it, maybe I shouldn't. But whenever my brother and I were teenagers, he turned 16 and my father gave him a car. It was an old car that was a spare. It was an extra. It was one that him and my mom had bought years earlier and our family outgrew it and it was just an extra. It sat for a while, but my dad took it, fixed it up, made it roadworthy and everything, and gave it to my brother at 16 years old. My brother paid nothing for that car. And he drove it like he paid nothing for it. And he abused it. He wrecked it a time or two. He despised that car. He badmouthed that car because he had nothing in it. And it's nothing against my brother's character, nothing. But it was just simply, it was given to him. He had no respect for it. Right? And so, hopefully, you know, the things that he is working for, the things that he's putting labor and effort, hopefully he's taking care of those a little bit better now. Right? And so we need to be careful, even in our possessions, even in the things that we have, to make sure to be honorable, even in our stewardship of things, right? Okay, and our last verse, and we'll quit here. In the way of righteousness is life, and in the path thereof there is no death. All through Proverbs, and definitely in chapter 12, we find this idea of path, and I've brought it up a few times tonight. We find the righteous versus the wicked. We find the diligent versus the slothful, the wise versus the foolish. There's choices, there's ways, there's different paths, different directions. Solomon is laying out a decision to be made. Which way are you going to go? You want to go with the righteous? You want to go with the wicked? You want to go with the wise? You want to go with the foolish? You want to go with the diligent, you're going to go with the slothful. We have all these decisions, what kind of a person we want to be. And so the only way for a man to be righteous, ultimately, is through Christ. And the only way for us to live righteous is to obey God's precepts and principles. Okay, there's a difference there. You guys understand that we are declared righteous whenever we trust upon Christ as our Savior. But then we desire to live righteously. We do that by obeying his word, by living according to his precepts. And so whenever we find these two different paths, there's only really two paths, the righteous and the unrighteous, the saved and the damned. And at the end of it all, those who are saved, God's way is life-giving on this earth and in eternity. The wicked are seduced in their thinking that their way is good, and if we aren't careful, we'll be seduced as well, sucked into a way that takes life rather than giving it. And so what it says here in verse 28, in the way of righteousness is life. He is saying, choose the living way. Choose the righteous way. Choose the way of diligence. Choose the way of wisdom. In the way of righteousness is life, and in the pathway thereof, there is no death. And that's because of Christ and eternal life. But still, in a temporal sense, in a right now sense, two different ways, way of life, way of death. Way that gives life, way that takes life. A way that walks with the life giver, a way that goes contrary to the life giver. And we have a choice. So with that being said, we'll end there tonight. Does anyone have anything to add to what we've looked at tonight? Any complaints or arguments? Okay.